This is an RNZ podcast.
No mai, whakarunga mai ki te o tai whenua. Welcome to Country Life. I'm Sally Murphy.
And I'm Duncan Smith. G'day. Today, a startup called Magic Beans is helping connect people and save money by swapping homegrown food.
The little bleats are coming thick and fast on a North Canterbury farm. Cosmo's there as the watching midwife.
And later on, Susan Murray's with a farmer whose business is at the start of the chain when it comes to increasing biodiversity on farms and public spaces.
But first, to our look at the conditions on the land this week, where for many regions, as we've heard in recent days, it's been simply appalling. Floods, slips, roads closed and power outages, and unfortunately in areas that have already been hard hit this year. Around the Bay of Islands, worsening weather during the week caused a lot of flooding. Some stock trucks weren't able to reach farms, so animal pickups were cancelled. There are already waiting times at most freezing works to deal with, and now there'll be even more animals waiting on farm for longer than planned. One stock agent says the rain has been absolutely pelting down and there's plenty of wind. It's mild though, about 17 degrees, which is a relief to sheep farmers. A farmer in Kaikoi says thanks to the warmth, his newborn lambs are mostly doing okay. Those in flood-prone areas of the north spent the week moving stock to higher ground. In Matakana, northeast of Auckland, strawberry growers have started their early picking, although the heavy rain kept them indoors for a few days. As it's early in the season, there aren't masses of berries to pick, so growers don't have to be in the fields every day. Good crops are expected with the warm temperatures. Even with the wet, the berries should be okay as they're planted on mounds above ground level.
Around Pukekohe, it was dry for more than a week until the rain arrived Wednesday. And that dry meant many hectares of potatoes were planted, as were onions, but these were sown later than usual. In Waikato, grass is growing again after a couple of robust frosts. 18-degree days and steady rain is keeping many farmers happy. Urea is going on to paddocks, calving's nearly complete, and one farmer says only two cows died, which is good going. Bay of Plenty kiwifruit orchardists are getting frustrated about not being able to spray the vines to enhance the fruit growth. The vines will be budding before they get the chemical on. Growers who spray their own fruit can work around this, but those who use contract sprayers need to book them in advance, hard to do in the wet. They're also concerned about the amount of fruit rotting once it arrives in Europe. It's mainly gold fruit, which is poor quality, but returns for both gold and green growers will be down quite a bit this season. Kiwifruit experts are currently trying to work out why stored kiwifruit are going bad so quickly. However, a grower says packing soft fruit that may explode and spread juice over other fruit is definitely part of the problem.
In King Country, lambing is in full swing for many. Winter jobs are continuing, such as repairing and upgrading wool sheds. One farmer commented he could do with a little more cattle tucker on the hills, but is pleased the weather is encouraging grass growth. Farmers wanting to book last season's lamb and dry ewes into the works are having to wait up to 6 weeks, as there are so many bobby calves booked in ahead, but that's expected to ease off soon. In Taranaki, calving is going so well that vets' winter business is down about 15% compared with usual for this time of the year. Farmers say it's pretty boggy underfoot. There has been some flooding, but they aren't complaining when seeing what others are dealing with.
Across the coast in Gisborne, it's wet again, and planting crops is continuing to be delayed. Harvesting is also a bit of a problem, with damp weather causing salad greens like lettuce to be poor quality. But cabbages have made it through the bad weather and are looking good. Further down the coast in Hawke's Bay, farmers are feeding out to cattle and there's a bit of ongoing pasture damage with so much moisture underfoot. Jack Frost has struck a couple of times, but the weather is milder than usual, so grass is growing.
Wairarapa is full steam ahead with calving and lambing. Other arable farmers are using the time to undertake restorative native planting, using flax, cabbage trees and akeake. Some locals are also pole planting poplar and willow trees on hillsides to prevent erosion. Meanwhile, due to a lack of feed on coastal hill country farms, stock are being moved down to flatter arable land for grazing. Farmers in the Nelson-Tasman region have been especially hard hit this week. Some parts have received more than double the normal monthly rainfall in just a few days. Infrastructure damage, such as slips and flooded roads, forced Fonterra to suspend milk collection in parts of Golden Bay on Thursday. Farmers are just trying to make the best decision at the time as they deal with floods and slips. Electric fences are underwater and shorting out, so animals are having free range in places. It will take a few days to assess the extent of the damage. Apple and kiwifruit orchardists are wading through sodden ground. It'll be a waiting game to see how much the surface water affects tree roots over the next month.
Coastal Marlborough farmers are seeing hill country farms slip onto roads blocking highway access. At the same time, the parasite Barber's poleworm is proliferating. A contact says higher rainfalls along with warmer temperatures have led to rapid grass growth, and it's attracted the parasite as well. Numerous sheep have dropped dead, but now the cause has been identified, drenching is underway. An Angus stud at the Conway River mouth in North Canterbury is calving. Each calf is weighed, tested for DNA and given an ID tag. They're recording the genetics of each animal to keep track of what it's eating and measure the methane output. It's been a week of unusual weather in Canterbury, with temperatures in the mid-teens, and they stayed high even when it rained. Farmers are trying to get onto paddocks to cultivate ready for spring sowing. Regular rain is making this job difficult.
Around Fairley, calving is well underway and rain started falling later in the week. Earlier snow has disappeared and it's currently having the expected winter wet conditions. On the west coast, a number of farms where Buller River tributaries or creeks run through farmland, there's been flooding, and those farmers will have a repair bill fixing some of the protection work that they'd only just done in February. The rain couldn't have come at a worse time. With calving well underway, it is stressed to the max for them.
In central Otago, the Australian curling teams are having their own national champs at the Naseby Rink. Sounds a bit like the Jamaican bobsleigh team. Meanwhile, the snow has been replaced with steady rain, and it's a waiting game to get the ewes shorn before lambing. Shearing gangs from the North Island are late coming down thanks to the wet weather delaying work up there too. Ewe scanning is just about finished, and for some the percentage is a bit lower than expected, about 160%. Southland is having a mild spring, and farming folks say despite wet weather they have nothing to complain about. The frosts have been impressive, with one duck shooting pond freezing over. Locals here are saying, as we all are, our hearts go out to the people in Buller and Nelson. It's really tough.
You're listening to Country Life on RNZ National, 101 FM.
If you've got a productive veggie patch or an oversupply of fruit from the tree in your backyard, you might consider joining an online community which is helping to save food, connect people and lower grocery bills. Judy Tyndall is a beanie, a member of the group Magic Beans, and she's linked up with one of its founders, Annalisa Hoff, for a food swap, so we tagged along too.
Hi Judy.
Hi Annalise, how are you?
Good, how are you?
It's good to see you again.
Yeah, you too.
Yeah. So I'm exchanging with you today some coombra plants, which is a bit of an experiment. So
I'm Judy Tyndall and I have been a gardener all my life and just enjoyed growing vegetables and giving them away to friends and sharing them around. And it was quite recently that I saw Annalise and Sarah talking about magic beans and thought, wow, that's special, because I often have spare produce. And so I joined up and I've been trading ever since.
So here are your gherkins. These are ones that I've done with some turmeric and mustard seeds.
Oh,
and it's
nice.
A combo I really like. And this is, I had three gherkin plants in a pot and they were just prolific. I think I got about 15 jars of gherkins out of them.
Wow.
Yes. I'm Annalisa Hoff and I'm a co-founder of Magic Beans, a community food sharing initiative that originally was started in January of 2016 as a Facebook group here in Hawke's Bay. And when I started the group, I thought it would just be my friends and some of their friends. But overnight, we had 400 people or so join, and it's just kept growing from there. My business partner and I, Sarah Grant, are looking at turning Magic Beans into an app, something that can be used globally. So we really want to share this initiative and this culture of Magic Beans, which is all about giving and sharing, localising more of our food and teaching each other how to grow food.
Planted in the ground, and hopefully you'll get a crop.
That'd be great. I haven't planted kumara before. How would I do them? Could I do them in a pot?
Oh, I'm sure you can. It's years since I've grown them, but I would have grown them in the ground. But I think anything grows in a pot, doesn't it, pretty
much? I think so. Well, it'll be an experiment for both of us, I think.
Yes.
I'm going to try it in a big pot.
Yes. It's been a wonderful experience. I've had lots of interesting trades. I've met a friend who I hadn't seen in 30 years, and we've been in touch.
I'll be most interested to hear how you get on, because if they do well, I'll do it again, because every so often I find a kumara tucked away somewhere that's sprouting.
I know the feeling. It really is peer-to-peer swapping, and it could be as simple as half a dozen lemons or a jar of jam or a bag of donkey poo or anything like that, really. I've got this quite romantic idea that there are Magic Beans gardens all over the place because of the circular nature of it, of people swapping and sharing. And sometimes I'll go to do a swap in a garden in Hawke's Bay, and you know, the person I'm swapping with will say, oh, that's from a swap I did last year with so-and-so, and that's from another swap I did the year before. And things, of course, keep self-seeding and growing and spreading into other gardens through swaps.
So it may not all just be harvested produce or seedlings. It could also be processed foods.
Oh, absolutely. The idea is that it is home-produced. So we have people swapping eggs, honey they produce at home, preserves and sauces. We also have a lot of collaborations for those home-produced items. So, for example, last year I had a tree full of grapefruit, but I didn't have time to make marmalade. So I got on Magic Beans and I found someone to collaborate with who I took around a whole lot of grapefruit, and she used her grandmother's recipe to make, I think, three different flavours of marmalade for us both.
What sort of stories are you hearing from some of those beanies out there? Are they talking about how this is a bit of a return to times gone by?
Most definitely. And I think that's something that I noticed almost immediately with Magic Beans, is that it was about so much more than the swapping. It was about community connections and looking after each other. And Sarah and I often comment on the fact that these days a lot of people have high fences. It's really easy not to know your neighbours. And we noticed with COVID that all of a sudden people wanted to connect more in their communities. They were going out onto grass verges and talking to each other and connecting and making sure each other were okay.
Who are the beanies?
We have members from 18 to 80 from all over the country, and they really vary in their gardening experience. And I have to say, even Sarah and myself, who started Magic Beans, we do not claim to be gardening experts. I learn as much from our beanies as they're learning from each other. And that is the kind of the premise of being a beanie. It doesn't have to be perfect, just give it a go. And so everybody encourages each other to do that.
What are the benefits for people involved in this?
One of the reasons we decided to move from Facebook and set up our own app is because once COVID hit, we could really see that supply chain issues were really scary for people, and that people were wanting to be more self-sufficient and to source more of their food locally so that they could be more resilient in these harder times. And also food was becoming more and more expensive, which it still is today, and it's a really pressing issue for a lot of families. So swapping and sharing food, growing your own food, is a great way to reduce your food bill, and also to know that you're eating something that's incredibly fresh. You know where it's come from, you know what sprays have been on it. And same goes for things that you swap in your neighbourhood. You're far more likely to understand know, where it's been, what it's got in it. That's a real advantage. There are huge environmental advantages to localising our food as well, and swapping and sharing homegrown produce. For example, a massive reduction in packaging. Also, just the reduction of food miles by localising your food. You know, you're reducing your carbon footprint just by growing and sourcing some of your food more locally.
And you're going to be developing this further?
That's correct. This is just a beta platform for us. We're gearing up to build our own custom app, which will just provide a lot more of a seamless experience and be easier to use for people to do their swapping and sharing and connect with other gardeners. And it also will allow us to very easily grow and move into other regions around the world, because we feel that this is something that can make a real impact in terms of changing the food system, localising more food, helping people to feel empowered about how they access their food, and also the difference that they can make just in their own backyard to climate change just by localising their food.
Annalisa Hoff, and you heard earlier from Judy Tindall. Magic Beans has about 5,000 members around the country.
Lambing is underway in the South Island, and to find out how it's going for a farmer in North Canterbury, Cosmo Kentish Barnes jumped into a ute to chat with busy Ashley Gorge farmer Alistair Bird.
We are just on the outskirts of Oxford, so we just come from the home farm, The Grange, which is a hill country sheep and beef place, and we're just heading through Oxford. We've got a lease block about 10 km away. So we're just heading there, and down there we're early lambing. So we started lambing about the 1st of August. And yeah, going down there doing a lambing beat, go down there every day, so just to make sure everything's good.
And when lambing first started, it was snowing.
Yeah, we've had a bit of rough weather over the last couple of weeks, so yeah, a bit of snow and very wet. We haven't had the cold, which is quite good, because that's the thing that'll kill the lambs is the wind chill. But lambing has been going really well. Survivability has been pretty good.
Tell me about your farm.
Yeah, so we're 560 hectares, generally all hill country, so about 40 hectares of flat and another 40 to 50 hectares of rolling country at the home farm. And then down here, the lease block, we've got 65 hectares, which is dead flat, traditional Canterbury dry land.
Yes, so great for the lambs.
Yeah, it complements our system. So we have a split lambing. So we lamb 1st of August down here, about 380 odd ewes. And then we've got a few cattle down here, and then we're wintered hoggets at the lease block as well. And then at home on the hill, we lamb 3rd week in September. So a bit later, just because of the altitude, we go up to about 660 odd metres in altitude is where we lamb. So a lot of snow in September up there.
How did you end up at your farm?
So, brought up in the Manawatu, came down here to go to Lincoln, met my wife, Jenna. She was at Canterbury when I was at Lincoln. So then her parents used to have a farm out on Carlton Road, down near the what is now Naitahu. So they converted that into dairy. And then just as they were about to sell that, well, they sold one block off and gave us the opportunity. We were currently on the West Coast working for Landcorp. Had 6 years over there. Gave us the opportunity to come back when this hill farm came on the market. So came back and they own it. We lease it off them and run our business out of that.
And do you and Jenna have children?
Yeah, we do. Yep, so we've got two girls, Millie, who is 11, and Georgia, who is 8. And so Millie's homeschooled and Georgia goes to Cust, the wee school down there.
Great life for the kids on the farm?
Oh yeah, no, definitely. That's one of the reasons that we decided to take this on, is we wanted, Jenna and I both grew up on farms, so we wanted to give our kids the same kind of lifestyle for them to grow up with as what we did. Yep. So we'll go and have a look at these single ewes that we're lambing and shedding off at the moment. So these are all a Perrondale ewe. Some of them have got a bit of Texel in them. And then, so these are all the older ewes. So they'll be 4 and 5 year old down here. and then we mated them with a terminal, so a South Suffolk, and pretty impressed with the lambs coming out at the moment. They seem to hit the ground and got a lot of vigour and jump up and feed pretty easy, yeah.
And we can see a few newborn lambs.
Yep.
Now in this paddock there are 100 or so ewes, and one of them is wanting to give birth, but the lamb's head is stuck, so Alistair is going to give her a hand.
Just a big, big lamb. It's a huge lamb. Mm-hmm. So these are singles. Yeah. It's been struggling for too long, so poor thing's dead. That's the nature of farming. You don't get it right 100% of the time. Mm. You always feel a bit disappointed. You know, think, what could I have done to make it change the outcome?
Yeah.
But, yeah.
The lamb does have a very big head.
Yeah, I think they normally swell up. She's struggled to get the front feet out. Mm. And then if the head's out for too long, it does swell up. Yeah.
This is the reality of farming, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, no, too right. Yep, we're just here to try and do the best we can and minimise the losses. And we normally work on a 10 to 15% death rate, I suppose, across all of the ewes. So we scanned 170% in both these singles and the twins, so this whole mob down here.
So when you do the lambing beat, what's are the main things you're looking for?
Yeah, just like this girl that we've just helped here, so anything that's having trouble. And then, yeah, we're also looking for mismothered lambs, which this year it's quite easy. We've got a lamb rearing set up back at home. So it's quite easy just to, if you're even on the fence about whether it's mismothered or not, just pick it up and chuck it in with the other ones there, so on the automatic feeders. Cast ewes is probably a big one at the moment too. So getting close to lambing if they haven't lambed already, full of grass, get on their side and can't get up, physically can't get up.
So the ewe has got up. What do you do with the dead lamb?
Oh, we'll take it home and put it in a hole.
So she's off back to the other sheep. Let's go and check on your other mob.
Yep.
Now we've come to a paddock where you've got some lighter conditioned ewes, and they've got a mixture of, twins and singles?
Yeah, correct. Yep. So we split them off just about 10 days before lambing, and then just put them in a paddock with a bit more feed, so preferential treatment. And they've picked up a bit of condition, so we'll be pretty close to halfway through in this paddock. There's a few lambs running around.
It doesn't take long for the lambs to buddy up with other lambs, does it?
No. Yeah, probably one of the most enjoyable things about lambing is if you come out here at 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon and all the lambs are joined up playing, jumping around and being little larrikins, it's quite cool to watch.
So how many lambs are you hoping to have on the ground by the end of lambing?
Across our whole business, I think we're aiming for about 1,800 lambs over the whole place. So that's both terminals and maternals at home.
Mm. Are lambs your main income on the farm?
Yeah, yep. So lambs probably account for, I'd say, about 60% of our income. And then cattle, calf sales will be another 20%, 30%, yeah. And then other farm income. So accommodation and bits and pieces would be another 10%, yeah. Mm.
And wool?
No, wool doesn't even cover the shearing bill at the moment, so, yeah, not a lot of income there.
Alistair, as well as running the farm, you've also got your own YouTube channel. Tell me about that.
Yeah, yep. called Kiwi Farmer, so been doing it just over a year. We've got 96 videos out.
That's a lot.
Yeah, it's been pretty consistent, like one to two a week over the full 12 months. It's just what's going on the farm, and then any issues we have. Tried to be kind of as open and honest as possible, not hide the things that maybe seem a little bit rough. Yeah, tried to put some finances in there, so what we're getting money-wise. Give people really a full broad picture insight into what we deal with.
Back at the home farm, Alistair's wife Jenna is busy rearing lambs that she plans to on-sell.
So we're in what is it, an implement shed that we've converted to our lamb rearing system. And there's about 30 lambs in here. Mm-hmm.
How much time do you spend looking after these lambs, Jenna?
Depends who you ask. Too much time. Because we're learning a lot about the systems that we're setting up, it's definitely an investment in time at the start. So we're raising our orphan ones, whether they're dropped off by mum or from the weather, and we wanted to continue doing that, but make it economical in terms of time and money. Coincide that with my family starting a sheep milking business a couple of years ago. They've got to the point now where they're deciding what they do with, you know, almost as an industry, what do you do with the boy lambs? Mm. And we chipped in and said, we reckon we could take a few off your hands, as well as any orphans. So that's why you see some funny little goat-looking lambs.
Mm-hmm. Some of your lambs are wearing cute little coats.
So my mum and my daughter got together and decided, so my daughter's 11, she loves sewing, and my mum loves sewing as well. And we had been given this huge big roll of woolen fabric that was end of line somewhere. It happened to have teddy bears printed all over it, but we didn't find use for it until now. And now my 11-year-old daughter has decided that she will sell me each one for a dollar.
Good business.
Yeah, and she convinces me that more of them need jackets than they do.
So how long will it be before they're put back out into the paddock?
Yeah, so early weaning in the sheep milking scenario is usually the earliest you can wean them off milk is 15 kgs. And then, depending, yeah, for us, it'll be putting them onto some good pasture and raising them to be, at the moment, it's that they'll be store, so sold somewhere else, or some might be finished, or some, if they're a good milking ewe, they might be sold back to the sheep milking operation. Some are obviously better some things than others. So there's ones in there that are just cruising along. They've got that terminal, that Suffolk breed, and they're meaty ass. And some of them are tiny little things. I mean, this is the newborn pen, so they're tiny. But, you know, they might grow out. And the different breeds, so the milking breeds are actually a really nice meat sheep as well, which most people don't realise. But they just take that little bit longer to fill out. So,
And you've got a new milk feeder. Tell me about that.
New for us, absolutely. So that's the fully automatic feeder, which is a bit of a game changer for us. That's something that had to happen if we were rearing a big number. The idea is that it mixes the powder in the milk itself when needed, as needed, and they can feed ad lib. So
Whenever they want.
Whenever they want. And we've always known that that raises the best lambs, because you watch them out in the paddock, they have small mounts often, and they just are happier, they don't get bloat, which is something that if people have tried to hand raise lambs, that can always be a bit of a deal breaker, is bloat. But until we get that one up and running, we've got another system here that's a heat wave system, and that's much simpler.
And so what's the feeding regime?
At the moment, it's getting to the point where we're mixing a lot by hand. But so the milk powder is in, you know, it comes in a big sack, and I'm mixing it up and pouring it into this heat wave and making sure that that doesn't run out. But just after lunch, I'll duck over the road, and there's half a dozen sheep that can be milked. So they've lost a lamb, or either the lamb's died, or it's ended up in here, or they've mismothered, or they've left it. So they've got a lot of milk, and just to keep them a little bit more comfortable, I'll milk them on a wee platform, and it will give us, I don't know, 4 or 5 litres of proper sheep milk. And I just mix it up, add it in at the moment in a ratio with the powdered milk, pour it in there, which is a bonus of having the heat wave because you can just pour it straight in. So that definitely bulks up the milk a bit.
We've come into the pen where the slightly older lambs are. Have you named any of these?
A good farmer would say no, but there are a few. Yes, there's Twiggy. She came in with eyeliner on, apparently, with the black around her eyes. And my daughter tells me that Twiggy is a famous model, fashion model, someone, designer. You might see a pattern here. There's also Christian Dior, who is here. He's got a great jacket on there. And then there's plain old Bluey.
You're my first boy, eh? Come on.
And he's just lovely. So we had a bit of a sore leg when he came in, but he's just beautiful now. And you? Yeah, unfortunately we can't. We told ourselves we can't get attached, but we do.
Yeah.
And they have their little groups as well, which is pretty cool. These big guys here, they came in a wolf edge. There's three. They were tiny in the middle of a storm, and they've just stuck together, just grown, and they all stick together. And then you've got these other little ones. I try and graduate them from the learning pen over to here in pairs or in threes, because they come into here and it's a whole new environment. And if they've got another lamb with them, they settle in quicker. You see, I do spend too much time here, don't I? Yeah. But no, see how they're just helping themselves now they've had their sleep? Wake up and help themselves.
Sounds like you really enjoy doing this sort of work.
I do. Yeah, I had to decide between this and going back. I'm not going back, but teaching, relieving. And I was on the fence, but now I tutor a few kids and have these guys in the day, so that's all good.
Hello.
Jenna and Alistair Bird there, talking to Cosmo at their Ashley Gorge Sheep and Beef Farm in North Canterbury. If you'd like to check out Alistair's videos, just type Kiwi Farmer YouTube into your Google browser and they'll come up. Or you can go to the Country Life webpage where we've put a link to his latest episode.
People might not know that milking cows isn't as bad as you think. You should probably give it a try one day.
Country Life, 101 FM.
Country Life is now off to a couple of beautiful spots near Cambridge in Waikato. The first place is very near the Maunga Totiri Ecological Reserve. It was one of the first areas to be entirely enclosed with a predator-proof fence a couple of decades ago, and it's here where a company called Restore Native, which is owned by beef farmer Adam Thompson, is working.
What do a schoolteacher, beekeeper, lifeguard, occupational therapist and dairy farmer have in common? Believe me, there is a link.
So you're one of the planters and the growers and the...
Be positive, Vanessa.
Vanessa's a dairy farmer.
Dairy farmer, yes.
Yes, yes. And this is what, your winter job?
It's my side job. At the moment I'm just doing a few days a week during calving, and then after calving finishes I'll come back every day.
Prefer one job to the other?
Dairy farming. But this has a really good feel about it because a lot of people get a lot of stick about being a dairy farmer, and this is my way of putting back by helping out with the natives.
Planting.
Yeah. Yep.
Hi, Hannah, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Very well. And were you a teacher before, were you?
I was a teacher.
And you're not missing the classroom?
Not one bit. I'm a country girl at heart and I needed to find something outdoors, and Adam's given me the perfect opportunity.
G'day, Leighton.
Hi, how's it going?
And are you full-time with this job?
Just part-time. I'm doing it over the winter. I'm normally a beekeeper and, this is a good winter job to fill in while the bees are hibernating. Yeah, just enjoying being out in nature and... Yeah, yep. It is good.
It looks like hard work, though. So this is a petrol-driven auger, is it? Or what are they called?
Yep. Yeah, that's
that
right.
That makes the hole?
Yep, yeah. It's not too bad, so long as the grass is short, we can get through quite a bit.
And great that it gives you, winter work, as you say, when the bees are quiet, you can be out doing something else. So where are we now? We've come to the base of Maunga Tatari.
Yeah, so this is beautiful. We're looking up a gully
And that's up into Mangatauteri, which is the fence sanctuary. There's 3,200 hectares up there, fully enclosed by a predator-proof fence. And we're planting this whole gully. There's 60,000 trees we're putting in here. So we've been here for a couple of weeks, and we'll be here for a couple of weeks more. Yeah, really big project. Māori-owned land, and just like really progressive people wanting to, yeah, restore the land back to what it once was. And so, yeah, they're stoked to see that restoration as we are to be here doing it. You know, they've got a much more long-term view than anything I've ever experienced, which is just bloody fantastic.
So that's the end part of Restore Natives' role. Where did it all start? Here's Adam Thompson again.
This is our third attempt, fourth attempt, third,
yeah,
maybe.
Yeah, we've been punished by the weather as we have this winter, so...
Yeah, what a time of it, eh?
But, same before, we plant trees in the winter and, we expect a little bit of rain, but the sun's shining.
So. I know, so we've got a happy day.
Yeah.
And we're on the outskirts of Cambridge. Your business that we're starting to look at here, Restore Native. Fill me in.
So we're a native plant nursery. We grow revegetation native plants. So primarily our customers are farmers retiring bits of land. And we also do a lot of council projects and some big sort of large-scale landscaping type projects too. But when we talk about restoring native, it's bringing that native bush back to areas on the land that should be, you know, that's its best purpose. Yeah, as a farmer ourselves, like myself, we're, the farmers are evolving and there's a lot more land retirement. So, yeah, we are geared to do that.
And how long have you been doing it for?
I've been growing trees for 10 years.
Wow, so you're a young man when you started.
Yeah.
You're only 36 now.
Actually planted my first tree when I was about 20 on my first property, well, second property. But yeah, I just love birds, and that's how it started. And then it was sort of like understanding that native bush connection, and you know, we started trapping predators, and then I got involved, and we met another guy, Peter Russell, started up the Predator Free group in Cambridge, and then that evolution of how the trees and the birds and the predators and everything connects, and then got into growing trees. Yeah, and we've been commercial now for 3 years. Yeah, at a larger scale. So yeah.
And what is larger scale? Let's see it.
We'll half a million trees this year, and we'll be over a million next year. So.
Gee. And client base, so you're saying, sort of mainly is farmers retiring land.
Yes.
Any particular age group or type of farmer?
This is really interesting, actually. And actually, our farm here is probably a prime example. We bought our farm off an older chap. He's 80 now. And he said to me last year, we were up a gully and we're planting some natives. And he said, oh, look, Adam, I cleared the tea tree, as he called it, off that that face there, 50 years ago. And here you are planting it back in now. But then he said, he admitted, like I spent 40-odd years spraying gorse out of there. And it's like, so it's those type of things where it's actually that land should have been left with the bush on it. But, you know, like back then, that was what you did.
That's what we knew.
Get clear land, that's the best way of productivity.
Yeah.
Build roads, it's what we do. But it's all tight. We have those older farmers, and obviously a lot of dry site farmers like us are normally older. But then we've got really progressive young farmers too who are looking at, hey, the market demand's changing. We need to be protecting the environment, and we need to be doing the right thing on farm, and it's just really cool, and really progressive people, really cool stuff happening. So, and that's why I'm probably out there on social media going, hey, look at this, this is what's actually happening out there. And we go all over the Waikato and we send trees all over the North Island, and it's really heartening seeing what's happening out there. And
I guess there's no average client, but sort of what sort of money are farmers putting into these projects?
Yeah, now it's incredible actually, how much money does go into it. You know, it's not cheap. Like we are selling trees for around $2.50, and it's probably that much a gain by the time you spray and plant it. For our average farmer, is probably someone planting between 2,000 and 4,000 trees. So they might be spending $10,000 or $20,000 a year, and they're coming back year after year after year.
And do they get ETS, carbon credits for the stuff they're planting?
So that's really interesting. Be careful of what I say here. there has been an inclination toward pine trees, and the legislation has been that way. And I'm sort of a view that probably when the ETS legislation came about, the pine tree lobby did a really good job. And pines obviously grow really fast, and they obviously do, you know, and they're large trees and they do sequester a lot of carbon, and no one's denying that. But natives kind of got a bit of a raw deal. So they have the lookup tables. They called it regenerating scrubland, not talking about proper planted native, which can actually have a quite an aggressive growth, and then if you get the tearing right in it, can sequester a heap of carbon and be a forever forest as well. So we do actually have quite a few clients who are doing, we're doing mixes of Manuka and Kānuka with things like Totara thrown in, so relatively cost effective, you know, so we can sort of establish them for maybe 2/3 of the cost of a normal native mix. It's still twice the cost of putting pines in, but you get a good long-term native forest, and you can then, ETS credits on it at a lower level than what pine trees give, but it's still often a better return than what some of those steep faces were giving in the first place, you know. No, it's interesting, and we're doing more and more of it, and we've got a lot of orders for next year, actually, that basically people putting in four ETS on farms, and they're just taking out the unproductive areas, and then
But happy to put it into natives rather than perhaps before they'd have looked at pine trees, wouldn't they? I guess on, you know, because that was, as you say, years back, you know, farm forestry, that was the big thing to do.
And there's definitely a place for it, you know. I'm not by any stretch anti pines. It's and where they can be harvested, you know, and that's fantastic, and that's returning back to our economy, which is awesome. But if it's going to be locked up forever, I think, you know, putting natives into it is the right thing by the land, and we just need to make sure that the controls are there to make it the right thing to do for the other reasons as well, you know. And now we're here on our own farm, you know, walking the talk of what we're saying we're doing. We're retiring a lot of, you know, our steep gullies back into natives and wet areas, and, you know, which is helping us with better subdivision of the farm and, you know, better stock management. So we're getting more out of what we are farming, but we're sort of retiring more and more every year too.
And mortgage broking. So
Well, that's a funny old one. I absolutely love it, and I'm still going to share in a business. So I've got four other business partners. So I still own a third in that business, and sort of spend 5 or 10 hours a week working in that. And then now it's another passion that I'm doing here. So just got an awesome team. We've got a dozen people.
That's 12 in the mortgage.
Yeah, 12 in the mortgage business.
How many in this business, and you're a sole native one?
So we've got half a dozen permanent staff.
More than a farm would employ, by a long shot.
And that's it. You know, if we look at here, the nursery sits on a couple of hectares, it's far more productive than the whole rest of our farm. And I think it's like for a lot of farmers, it's that little bit of diversity gives them some balance. A lot of people around here doing a little bit of horticulture and stuff like that. But yeah, it's great. And then we've got 14 in total on the payroll at the moment, because being our busy planting season, this is our busiest time of the year. Oh, this is kind of my project space.
And has this all been trial and error?
I famously say that you learn a lot by killing trees. And so, I've killed a lot of trees to learn a lot of lessons. Anyone can grow a tree, but it's getting it to the right size at the right time of the year in an aggressive growing state where it's going to survive when it goes in. And so, you can see we've got a bit of equipment in the back here. There's a drum seeder there. The seed collecting thing's cool. It's we collect our seed locally, you know, the trees grow well locally, and we try to identify some good specimens and know that that's what we're putting out there. And I'm a little bit of a crazy man in the summer and autumn. I drive around with a secateurs and a big long pole pruner, and if I see a tree fruiting or seeding that I want to get seed from, I pull over the side of the road, I'm cutting things down, and it's awesome, because, you know, we know then when our plants go out the door that we've seen their parent plant. It's cool.
And for the stuff you've planted here, you see you've got a stream and things here, what impact have you seen the plantings having on your place?
Yeah, well, this is incredible. When we first came here, this wasn't fenced or anything, and there's a bank just over here which was sort of collapsing in progressively. As we go further up the farm, along this creek, you know, we've protected that now. There's basically no cattle in its water source, you know, so the sedimentation and nutrient loss out of our farm is basically going to be bugger all. Only 5 years ago, cows walking through those streams, or pushing dirt into them. You can't fix that overnight, you know, and even for an individual farmer, the cost we're talking about earlier, they just got to chip away every year and do a bit more. Should we go up and have a look at the bush? We'll just jump in the ute and we'll go up and have a look at these traps.
Excellent.
Cool.
Busy life though. How many kids are you fitting into this?
Two of them. Six and three. So they're great. And it's one of the big shifts for me away from a more corporate type career, spending more time in the nursery, is
you know, I'll pick the kids up after school or whatever and take them down in the nursery and they'll run around and start to teach them how to pot plants so they can make some pocket money. So, you know, that's good. So
fill us in on this bit. So predator control as well. What's this?
So we've got 14 hectares here in a covenant, mainly kakatea, a lot of kānuka and stuff regrowth, and then up the top we've got a lot of old santawa and pukatea and even a big rimu. And yeah, really, this was actually the thing that really sold me on the farm. Look, come up here and I just love the bush, and the opportunity to have big old stand native and to be able to protect it is just awesome. So planting trees is one thing, but you know, where there are birds and there are food, there are rats and there are possums and there are stoats, and just always building on the network in here. I think at the moment we've probably got about 30 odd traps in here, mainly rats, possums, mustelids.
So, and you're obviously getting involved in Cambridge earlier, you mentioned.
We basically started out with a bit of a crazy idea, and Peter Russell is a good bugger, and we sat down and had a coffee and said, yeah, let's try and put some traps out there. So we built some traps and went into people's backyards, and you know, a heap of other people are involved with it, really driving, you know, rats and possums and backyard stuff. And so we're looking after our backyard, and like where we're standing is a little stream running through here. And this is amazing. We were out here, probably only 3 months ago, and, you know, we've only farmed for a few years. And it was late at night, I was coming back with the kids, and I had my head torch on and looking, and there's freshwater crayfish in the stream, and I never even knew. And yeah, but we'll go and have a look at a trap.
Cool. Yeah, and it looks beautiful clear, the stream. Wow.
Oh, that's awesome, eh? And it's better, you know, as well. Like the stones in the bottom of that stream weren't there, you know, but now we have removed, you know, the cattle from further up the headwaters, that this is starting to clear up. So it's amazing how quickly nature bounces back when you give it a helping hand.
Okay, so.
So yeah.
Oh, gross!
Yeah, how good. So this one's
did
been.
Did you save this for me?
This one's been working. No, I haven't been down here for about a month. That's just perfect. So this is an AT220 automatic trap, and it basically kills rats and possums. And I've had a trail cam on another one further up, and it's amazing. You see a rat come for 3 or 4 days and kind of have a bit of a look and a little look around, you know, and then eventually, bam, you know, like, so it's. Yeah, they're great. And, you know, to have this, like, constantly, you know, on the go, it's employee of the month,
you
know?
Pretty
soon the birds are going to start breeding, and there's less predators around trying to munch on them. It's just happy days, really. So,
are we going to make that 2050 predator-free?
Yeah, it's really funny. It's very easy to go, oh, no, we won't, and, you know. But when I look at the gains, like, I've only been trapping stuff for 10 years, maybe. You know, it'll be incredible what's going to happen in the next 10 years. And because it's like a real country goal, like everyone's sharing their information around, hey, we can do this better, we can do that better, we can, you know, which is just awesome. Like, it is entirely attainable if, you know, we keep innovating. We're Kiwis, we're good at that.
And just to end quickly, we head back to that innovative sanctuary, Mangatātari.
Right.
Easier,
a little bit slippery on the farm track.
Yeah, give the project a bear.
There you go, you're
going to
be famous.
No, you go for it.
I
want to talk to you.
I'm the sanctuary manager up here at Mangatātari.
Sanctuary manager.
I run the whole 3,500 hectares up here.
Oh, and your name? Yeah.
Bodie Taylor. What do you want to know?
Oh, and what does that involve, running the sanctuary?
Team collaboration and making sure that what we do is basically we've got 47 Ks around the whole of the bush up there. And with our landowners and with our stakeholders and also mana whenua, the iwi, we basically look after all our biodiversity and species within our taonga inside the actual ngahere.
And how have you seen it develop since the fence has been in?
Oh, it's fantastic. The foliage in there is just unbelievable. So it's almost gone back to a virgin state. The fence is amazing.
Did you think it would be that successful?
I was here years ago, going on 20 years ago, when they were first talking about it. And to be honest, it was, no, I don't think anyone did.
And good that they're planting up down the corridors coming off as well.
See these green deserts we call farms, right? They need the balance. And so in the gorges here, it's great to see Restore out here doing the hard yards with the community. And they are, the people that plant those trees are all just mums, dads, whoever, teachers, whoever, doctors, lawyers, all coming up because they just know how important it is to balance the whole ecosystem of farmland and and the ecosystem of our native trees.
Excellent.
You're seeing everything now, Susan.
I've seen it all, right.
Yeah. What do you do?
Adam Thompson, farmer and owner of Restore Native. Like Alistair Bird you heard 20 minutes ago, Adam has a strong social media presence, so check him out.
Well, that's all we've got for this week. Now, do check out our stories on the Country Life webpage if you've missed anything or want to hear them again. And, as always, you're welcome to email us with your feedback or story ideas at country@rnz.co.nz. And fingers crossed that rain lets up. Have a good weekend. Bye now.
Catch you next time.